Monday, good morning to you.
Morning, may it please the court, please approve justice.
Take a second, President. I'll let you know. That is a cur. You may proceed.
Thank you, may it please the court, may it please justice. I'm Brian Monroe, attorney for Nicholas Eli, who appeals the denial of proceeding in form of papas, motion for appointment of counsel, motion for post-conviction relief, and motion to recuse the judge. First off, the state can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that though the state on page 46 and 47 and 3 agrees that Mr. Eli should have been granted his motion to proceed in form of papas, his motion for appointment of counsel. And in doing so, it seems that the state also clearly concedes the proposition, and I'm quoting from page 46 of the state's brief, most of Eli's claims are not procedurally barred. Or I would cite 2 State versus McHenry, 268, Nebraska 219, which states, when a defendant was represented both at trial and on direct appeal by the same lawyers, generally speaking, the defendant's first opportunity to assert ineffective assistance by trial counsel is in the motion for post-conviction relief. We also know from a long line of cases that if the motion alleges only conclusions of law, or fact or law, or the records and files in the case affirmatively show that the newlyn is entitled to no relief, no evidentiary hearing is required. And I'd like to point to a fairly recent case that was decided in May of this year, and that case is State versus Muhammad Abdul-Qadir. It was decided in May of 2016. It's 293 Nebraska 560. In Mr. Abdul-Qadir was an inmate in prison and was in an altercation in which he began stabbing another inmate. And following a jury trial, he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. He alleged on appeal that the district court erred. He filed post-conviction relief, was denied an evidentiary hearing, and alleged that the state erred, that the district court erred, denying an evidentiary hearing. This court affirmed the denial, but in doing so, it set, I think, a pretty good guide for us in these types of cases in terms of what we should look for in post-conviction. It indicates that Mr. Abdul-Qadir wanted to call 2 witnesses, and he, in his post-conviction relief, alleged that these witnesses would have given testimony favorable to him. And this court said that's not good enough. Mr. Abdul-Qadir does not allege that Planter would have introduced any additional facts at the trial, nor would it contradict any facts presented by the state about what occurred. So I think that's a pretty good guide in this case, and I would refer the court to Mr. Healy's post-conviction motion, the fourth issue which he raises, in which he indicates that there were 2 people who he wanted to call the test court. And he states in his post-conviction that it would have changed the outcome of the trial. Taylor Sporman would have testified about the text messaging that was not out of his intent to commit the robbery, but instead was a form of venting. She would have testified that this defendant was filling out an application looking for a job, and she agreed to help him financially until he had a job and was stable. It's also extremely important because in closing argument, the state argued the text messages and as it went to Mr. Healy's intent. Closing argument by the state was, and you heard an instruction about intent, and that intent is a state of mind. Normally, you would have to infer intent from circumstantial evidence, except in this case, you heard testimony of what Nicholas Healy's intent was. You don't have to look into his mind because he flat out tells you what his intent was from the text message that he sent out. So I would suggest that that issue, as well as the other two issues that the state appears to stipulate that should be sent back for an evidentiary hearing, should be included.
Are you telling us the counsel's Flamingo appointments, counsel's appointments, who would testify to interpret the text message?
Mr. Ely states that she would have testified that the defendant what the text message meant. The text message was sent to her, apparently. And the other thing, Your Honor, is that there were 20. Well, he needed to call her. I don't know. I think she could. It's important to note as well that she's not. I think it's important to note that there were 29 text message conversations between Ms. Sporban and the defendant, and only one of them came in at trial. So without an evidentiary hearing to allow us to develop this, it would be impossible to really determine, you know, what she would have testified to. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Can I please support counsel and the state House Assistant Attorney General representing the Appalachian State of Nebraska? Because the standard review in this case is unknowable, I felt the need to go through each and every one of Mr. Eli's claims in his motion because the district court order in this case was clearly wrong in the state. Eli's ineffective assistance of trial counsel and ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims cannot be procedurally barred because he had the same counsel at trial and on direct appeal in the district court order. Found them all to have been known or unknowable on direct appeal, and thus all procedurally barred. I conceded that two of Eli's 29 claims warrant an evidentiary hearing. One is his ineffectiveness to trial counsel claim for failing to advise him of his right to testify. His allegations are sufficient. The record does not refute it. And second, his ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim for failing to raise on direct appeal that the district court erred when it denied him his right to proceed, so say at trial. Again, his allegations are sufficient and the record did not include it. The state submits that the rest of his claims fail either because his allegations are insufficient or the records and files affirmatively show that he is entitled to no relief. Because his two claims, the state submits two of his claims warrant evidentiary hearing, his motion for IFP status should have been granted. They're obviously not frivolous. They don't obviously lack merit. His motion for counsel also should have been granted because there are judicial issues of law and fact. But as for his motion for recusal, the state submits that the court correct in refusing it or denying it. Eli has argued nothing and provided no evidence of actual bias or judicial impartiality on that motion. With regard to the claim that Mr. Munley spoke about, the statement that with regard to one of the witnesses, Eli made insufficient factual allegations, he did not allege that he was never in possession of this phone at any time, or who did text this witness if he would not, or how did that witness know that it was not Eli who texted him. With regard to Sporvin, which is the one that Mr. Munley mainly talked about, being the tailors of the texting Taylor Sporvin, he cannot demonstrate prejudice when the introduction of the additional text really wouldn't have changed the fact that he texted her a day before the robbery that he was going to commit a robbery. In any event, or in any event, about her stating what she either said. I don't think, no, I don't think she can testify as to what his, what she believes his intent was. In any event, there's two eyewitnesses who can't place Mr. Eli at the same time. So again, I don't think he can demonstrate that.
You already said that she conceived the trial court's things that they claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, appellate counsel are not procedures. No, that's not what I'm asking. Aren't there several claims that go directly to the trial court? And aren't those claims procedures?
Yes, they are. So the district court order was correct on that. The district court order found everything and procedurally barred. Offered position of asking you to reverse the demand with directions to the district court to grant Mr. Eli an evidentiary hearing on the new claims that I conceded to grant his motion for IP status and to grant his motion for IP.
Were it not for the granting of an evidentiary hearing, there would be no reason for a trial court to grant the motion IOC filed with a motion of the post-conditional plea because there aren't the costs associated with such a motion.
Correct.
So the error of not granting the IOP has to do with the specific error of that error, I'm sure the error was not filed.
And because of your argument.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He has 3 minutes, 25 seconds. 25 seconds. 25 seconds.
Thank you. I know that this is de novo review, and I think I may know the answer, but I think perhaps the court has something to think about. When the trial judge was incorrect in determining that the claims were potentially barred, this court has stated in numerous cases that an evidentiary hearing of post-conviction trial judge prior to fact resolves conflicts in evidence and questions of facts, including credibility and weight to be given to witnesses' testimony. And that this court, when reviewing claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, reviews the factual findings of the lower court for error. So there was no factual findings. And perhaps the court was going to say the judge made the wrong ruling, but really when you review it de novo, we can affirm his ruling. I don't know if the court's ever said that. But that's just something that I would offer as to whether that's going to set a precedent as to when a judge incorrectly rules whether the state can fill the shoes of the judge and make the claims on the appellate level, which is doing this. Thank you
very much for your appointment, Mr. Madden.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your assistance.
You're welcome.
Next case of the day is Esterman versus Bowers.
Come on.